Welcome to Haldane Law Matters. Thank you. Today's guest is hard to describe in some ways because he is firstly an adventurer. He has a career in the army, in the Gurkhas. He has an extensive knowledge of Nepal. He is a jazz musician, both playing piano and singing. And last but not least, he has a legal career that spans many years, not only in Hong Kong, but London. Neville, welcome.
Thank you very much. It has been suggested that I actually moonlight as a silk.
I think that's probably accurate. And by the way, I'm very privileged to have you here. You've been very hard to track down and to get here. And I suspect that that's all to do, if I may say so, with a very busy life that you lead.
It's pretty full.
Yes. Yes.
But that's what life's for.
It is. We shouldn't give up, should we?
No.
Can I take you back a few years, if I may? Can I take you back to the beginning, not the very beginning, but somewhere along the lines of education, so that our listeners can know just a little bit, a moment or two, about your early life?
Depends how far back you want to go. I think you can go back to something I mentioned to you before, during the war, when my father moved us to Yorkshire, to Huddersfield. And I remember the school there because I walked up the road to that school. And the reason I think I remember that school is because I had a lovely wooden tomahawk. I had developed a capacity for throwing this tomahawk, which I did on the school premises, and unfortunately broke a window, which somehow didn't commend me to the teaching staff. So that was something that I carried away from my early education.
Well, you were very lucky, if I may say so, as a Yorkshireman, to find yourself in Yorkshire. Was Huddersfield what it's reputed to be? Rather, how shall I put it, without getting into trouble from people in Huddersfield?
Well, Huddersfield is, in its own way, unique even in Yorkshire, because it isn't an industrial town, but it does have, I think, a cloth industry. Mm-hmm. And I met somebody the other day who said that finest quality wool is still being woven in Huddersfield. So they've managed to carry on with that industry. I think the thing that struck me was that within 10 minutes, I could be in the open Yorkshire countryside, which, as you know, is absolutely stunning. So to have that on your doorstep, a big plus.
A good place to hang out during the Second World War.
That was a very good place to hang out during the Second World War.
And I think you were with your family, and your father was an entertainer, I know. In fact, a well-known entertainer, if I may say so, yes?
Yeah, in fact, it could be quite embarrassing, because you're always being introduced as his son. You were never yourself. You're always Leslie's son. Initially, you thought that was okay, because it got you into places. If you wanted to go to the cinema, you get free seats. Get to into the theatre, you'd always get front row and that sort of thing, which is huge. But probably the lasting value was this secondary growing up in the theatre and being aware of live entertainment, the like of which there is nothing to compare. And I developed a real love for the theatre. I used to go in whenever I could. If my father took us to wherever he was performing, I would try to get in every night to watch him. I probably knew his act off by heart. That and seeing some of the famous entertainers of that time up close, you took it for granted. Now I look back and I think, wow, how very lucky I was.
Yes, yes. Mm. Did that ignite your own love for the theatre and for music?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely.
Were your musical tastes similar to your father's?
I think, if I'm really honest, the answer is probably yes. But I moved towards jazz, and he wasn't a big jazz enthusiast. I don't know why, because quite a lot of the music that he wrote became very popular as jazz numbers. And I remember him saying, why do you listen to this when you could be listening to some Tchaikovsky or some Mozart? But then if you listen to what he wrote, anything further removed from Tchaikovsky and Mozart, it would be hard to find.
Was it music hall?
Oh, it's music hall, and music hall evolved into variety.
Yes.
But he started writing when he was in the First World War. He said he found he could write songs when he was serving in the First World War. So I think he wrote nearly 600 songs.
goodness. Were they were published?
All published, and my brothers and I, we still get the royalties.
Oh, fantastic. Good old dad.
Yes.
And if I can fast forward now to the last couple of years, you've kept going with your musical shows to some extent in Hong Kong. I forgot what the name of the pub is that you play at.
Oh, Ned Kelly's.
Ned Kelly's, of course.
Yeah, Ned Kelly's, which is an institution. It's one of Hong Kong's great institutions. Set up in 1972.
Was it?
They say it's the oldest jazz pub in Asia. Still going strong. And they have live jazz there 5 nights a week.
Well, that's a good plug for Ned Kelly's. We shall all go and have a listen.
Definitely.
And I think it's right to say that you played recently with one of your fellow senior counsel, and that's Ian Winter.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
He was doing a gig, I think, with his saxophone down in Causeway Bay.
Yes, which sadly has closed.
Another victim of COVID.
Yes.
I see. Yeah. And that must have been a great night. I think, in fact, I missed it only partially because I left at half time, knackered, and you were on in the second half.
Yeah.
Good. Now, can I just take you into your army career? Can you tell us a little bit about that, joining the Gurkhas, why you did and what it was like?
I was almost going to say by mistake. There came a point in time at the Mons, the officer cadet school, where you were told you have to nominate which regiment you want to be commissioned into. So since my father had been in the London Scottish, which was the territorial arm of the Gordon Highlanders, I thought, fine, well, I'll go into the Gordons. But I had seen a sign saying that you could join the Sultan of Muscat and Oman's levies. And if you did, I think you got an immediate captaincy, regular rates of pay, and by signing on for an extra year, there was a bounty at the end. And there was quite an interesting war going on in the Radfan. So that sounded to me like a really good way to spend the next 2 or 3 years. So I went to see the Highland Brigade representative and told him that this is what I plan to do. And he said, "You mean to say you don't want to spend your time with the regiment?" I said, "No, I want to go do something useful." He said, "Well, in that case, I don't think we want you." And I was rejected. My father, when he found out, was apoplectic. And I was walking past our company commander's office, and he grabbed hold of me and he said, "Come here. Your father is going to have a question asked in Parliament as to why you have been rejected." He said, "You must stop him at all costs." I said, "Yeah, well, he's difficult." He said, "Get on. Here's the phone. Call him now." So I did explain to him. My father couldn't understand. I said, "Look, I am told that if I'm going to have any sort of military career, it will be blighted if this question is asked." And so with great reluctance, he had the question withdrawn. So there I was, on the face of it, floating. But sometimes one door closes, another opens. I was very lucky. I became the senior under officer for that intake, which more or less gave me a choice of any regiment I wanted to go into. So I thought, fine, I'll go into the Scots Guards, and I'll still go to the Sultan of Muscat and Oman's levies. So I was on my way to the Brigade of Guards representative when I was collared by an officer in our own company who said, "Where are you going?" I told him. He said, "No, you're not. You're coming with me." He took me off, and he sold me the Brigade of Gurkhas in about 5 minutes. Although he wanted me to join his regiment, which is the 2nd Gurkhas, I finished up in the 7th Gurkhas.
7th Gurkhas, yes, yes.
Which was, of course, probably one of the greatest privileges I have ever been introduced to.
I know that you were very proud of that in that period. And in fact, do you sometimes regret leaving the army?
No, I don't regret it because it was a very careful decision. I was in Malaya. My commanding officer, who was absolutely superb, wanted me to stay on. And the brigade commander, who was at that stage, I think he was the last fighting general we had, Brigadier Walter Walker, he was our brigade commander, and he was very, very keen on me staying. And I had the papers on my desk. I just thought, I'm actually enjoying this too much. And added to which, I realized that I have a difficult streak within me. And when I was given orders which were patently stupid, I found it very difficult to deal with that. And I realized that if I was going to have a career, that would probably get in my way. So I thought, right, the balance is don't stay. I'd already joined Gray's Inn, so it was just a question, do I stay or do I go back and read law?
a big bit in the middle, I think, isn't there, which is Nepal.
Yeah.
So you joined the Gurkhas, and I think I'm right in saying at some point you became a married man?
Yes. After I came back to the UK, I went to the LSE to read law. And I think within a few months of coming back from the UK, the Queen was presenting a new pipe banner to 6 Gurkhas, and all serving and retired officers were invited to this private reception at the palace. So I went along, and there was this stunning Nepali girl who was studying nursing at St. Thomas's, and cutting a long story short, we got married.
Yes, and for those that want to know more about Nepal, I've just finished reading, you'll be pleased to know, Council in the Clouds, A Personal Odyssey, and that's your autobiography.
It's a memoir which basically covers the years that we spent in Nepal.
Yes, and I have to tell you, I genuinely enjoyed it.
I'm happy to hear that.
And I ended up feeling I knew you much better than I did before reading it, for better or for worse. And it paints a picture, a very romantic picture, really, not easy, but romantic life in Nepal in the 60s.
Yes.
Tell us just a little bit about how you found Nepal in the 60s as an expatriate, of course.
It's interesting that you point to the fact that I was an expatriate, because I think what I really wanted to do, I wanted to be accepted by the Nepalese community.
Yes.
I wouldn't say it dominated all my thinking, but it was very much the underlying motive behind so much of what I did. I fell in love with the country, the people, and I wanted to be accepted.
Yes. You learned the language, I think.
Oh, yes.
If I can tell listeners on the way in, there was a Nepalese lady running the foyer, and she burst into Nepalese, yeah. And you responded beautifully.
It's my second language, and my wife taught me to read and write a script, which was key to being able to speak properly.
Yes.
And so we went to Nepal, which was, again, an adventure. We were talking about risk at one stage. After graduating and being called, I'd already fallen in love with the Far East, and I wanted to come back. So I thought, when I got the opportunity to take the Foreign Service exams, I took those, got in. So I did 2 years in the Foreign Office, thinking that I'd be posted abroad. And of course, I wasn't. I spent those 2 years in London, which I hated. It was incredibly frustrating.
And what was frustrating about London? Everything.
Well, I wasn't doing what I really wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to be abroad. I wanted to be amongst people. I wanted to be doing more interesting things rather than sitting in an office. I was doing very interesting work, because it was the Borneo confrontation, and I was involved in services liaison. You probably remember in the book, I was proposed to go as the Foreign Office representative, a liaison officer to what he had then become General Walter Walker, my ex-brigade commander. And so I was quite excited about that, because it meant that I could do all the things I really wanted to do. But he then sent a signal back saying he wouldn't have me. And some years later, I broached this with him at a cocktail party. And I said, so tell me, General, why did you refuse me? And he said, well, I was brought up to believe that you only marry in your own race.
Those were the days.
Yes.
Thank goodness they've moved on. Were you very angry?
I think I was disappointed more than angry, because I realized in those days, the idea of mixed racial marriages was still pretty rare. Mm. And there had been a Gurkha officer, Eric Brighton, who married a lovely, partly Tibetan girl, and he'd been chucked out of the brigade because of that.
Really?
Again, she was highly educated, very sophisticated, but it didn't cut. So we finished up. We had many invitations to go to Nepal, and people said, look, we think that you can actually do something for us. So we did a reconnaissance. We went out, which was exciting. So I packed up, and we went back to live in Nepal. And just outside Bombay, a truck hit me, and we lost our windscreen.
And your wing.
And the wing. So we hobbled mechanically into Delhi, where I managed to get the coach work done. Brilliant.
Yeah.
You would never know that car had been touched by anything. Their coach work was so good. But getting the windscreen, that was a different story. Even though I'd paid for it to be airshipped, hadn't arrived. So we drove from Delhi to Kathmandu without a windscreen.
I must tell you, Neville, I'm smiling now because I love that part of the book. I love that part of the book. It brings all the adventure. It's that sort of young blood adventure as you take all the risks, calculated as they were, no doubt, and end up in Nepal, having crossed the mountains, I think, yes? And then, of course, Nepal for years became your home.
Yes.
And I think you set up a law practice there. You were the only person in Nepal that wasn't Nepalese.
Yes.
With a license?
Yeah.
That must have been fun.
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was just amazing. It was very small.
Well, Nepal was very small, wasn't it?
Nepal was very small. But it attracted interesting people. So it was full of characters.
Yes.
Rogues, villains, adventurers. And you could sit around the fire at night, particularly in the old Jack and Yeti bar. And all these wonderful people would come in. You'd have Edmund Hillary sitting down beside you and people would be telling stories. It was magical.
I'm sure it was. And I have to tell you, I remember the Yak and Yeti, I think, because I booked many, many years ago a holiday in Nepal through, I think, a travel agent that belonged to you and your wife.
Yep.
Would that be right?
That's correct.
And that was my experience in Nepal, and it was great, by the way. I loved it. I guess we did a hike of some sort.
You did a trek, I think.
Yeah. I think we did the trek. So with reading the book, it all came flooding back. I found it extremely engaging, I have to tell you. So, and then there was the Fishtail Lodge, of course, because that became a pivotal hotel for tourism, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Fishtail was the brainchild of Prince Basundhara, the king's second brother. There were three brothers, King Mahendra, Prince Himalaya and Prince Basundhara. And Basundhara was a really interesting guy. He'd had a military career, and he was incredibly popular in the Nepal army. So much so that the king was afraid of his popularity, and he made him resign from the army.
Didn't like the competition.
He didn't like that. And so Basundhara had to do other things. People thought of him as a playboy, and he was a playboy. But he did a lot of really good things. He invested in tourism in Nepal, put his own money in, and Fishtail Lodge was the first quality hotel to be opened in Pokhara, which is to the west. It's a lovely, lovely area. It has a beautiful lake. Fishtail is right on the banks of the lake.
I have bathed in the lake. Mm. It's a very beautiful country and lovely people.
Yeah.
And the most endearing children.
The children are unbelievable.
They're
to die for. When we're talking about children in Nepal, I'm a trustee of the Nepal Umbrella Foundation, which was set up by some Irish people to help to rescue and rehabilitate children who had been trafficked. That's both boys and girls. And it was a wonderful, wonderful organization. We have managed to restore nearly 500 children to some form of self-respect. And the last time I was up, we got some of them to help me on a book promotion. And they were absolutely wonderful. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, the trauma that these children have been through, and now here they are, they're looking forward, they're planning their futures. This is something really worthwhile.
That sounds a heartwarming story, Neville. I was there about 35, 40 years ago, and I was there with my wife, and I was married in those days. And we were both very taken by the Nepalese people generally and the enthusiastic welcomes we got everywhere. And the children were just big smiles and chattering away in an adorable way. So eventually, with a heavy heart to some extent, no doubt, you decided you'd lived your life in Nepal and there was another life to be had in London.
I think there were two factors. I really wanted to come back to the bar in England. And I felt that we had run out of opportunities in Nepal, because in those days, we didn't have banks with a lending capacity big enough to fund the big industrial projects which people wanted to mount. And they didn't have the sophistication to be able to do consortia. And so the people had very good ideas, but they couldn't fund them. And I thought, well, I think we've run this as far as we can. It's time to go back.
I see. And that was to the law.
Yes.
So finally, we perhaps can come back to the law, reminding ourselves that this is something to do with the law.
Something to do with the law.
And you became what, a QC fairly quickly?
No, I was a junior.
Always a junior there?
I was always a junior there.
Can I tell you, I don't think I've ever told you this, but jumping ahead a little bit, came to Hong Kong for the first time, I think, or at least for the first time professionally, you set up business here. We'll come to that.
Yeah.
I got a letter from John Matthew QC. Have I told you this story?
No.
I got a letter from John Matthew QC, who you and I would probably agree was, in our lifetime, the most impressive, the best advocate, criminal law advocate.
He was in some ways the doyen of the criminal bar in London.
Yeah, he was wonderful. I worked extensively with him, and I was very lucky to do so. And he said to me, there's a young fellow called Neville Cerrone on his way out. And you want to keep an eye on him because he's very talented indeed. So I'm glad to be in a position. I've saved that for you, by the way. I'm very pleased to be able to tell you the very finest of advocates was putting you in a category where we should watch out because you were very talented indeed.
Now, John was a good man.
Yes, he was an interesting man.
Oh, very interesting.
Very down to earth.
Yes.
He was friends with the Cray brothers, I think.
Well, we all had a close association with people of a dubious character.
Yeah.
Because it was the nature of our work. And yet, I divide my clients into two broad categories. There are the professionals, and there are the victims of circumstance. Together, we represented a particular victim of circumstance. I think it's one of the only two or three cases of effectively treason involving the Queen.
I know the story, but our listeners may not.
It was a young man. I think he was 16.
Yeah.
And he had psychological problems. And he went to the Trooping of the Colour with a starting pistol, and he fired it up into the air. It is said that it startled the Queen's horse. But being an excellent equestrian, she had it under control in no time at all. He was pounced on immediately and dragged away. But he was charged with treason. And so I was instructed to represent him. I had very strong views. I said, this is grossly over-egging the pudding because there are two elements to that particular section of the Treason Act. And they were charging him with the more serious one. And I said, this is really, it's a storm in a teacup. But within no time at all, we heard that the Attorney General, Michael Havers, was going to prosecute. Geoffrey Lane, who was Lord Chief Justice, decided he would return from Australia to try the case. And I said to my solicitor, don't play their game. If you bring in a silk, you're saying, yes, we agree, it's really serious. You leave the case with me as a junior, and that forces them to realize that actually they're really over-egging the pudding seriously. But he said, well, I might be criticized. And I said, all right, but if you're going to get somebody, get John Matthew. So John came in, we did it together. We got a sentence, and I said to John, we've got to appeal this.
Was it a trial?
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
But we pleaded. We pleaded.
We pleaded, okay.
And I said, John, we have to appeal this. And John said, appeal the Lord Chief Justice? I said, yes. So we went to the Court of Appeal. We didn't get anywhere there either. But
what did the poor boy get then?
He got something like 2 or 3 years imprisonment.
For firing a starting gun into the air. Governments can be harsh.
It was what I regard as a gross misperception. They were saying, yes, well, the horse could have thrown the Queen. Come on, these horses are trained not to react
to gunfire,
to this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the Queen is one of the finest horsewomen in the country. If she couldn't control a startled horse, nobody could.
Was there ever an explanation as to why he did it?
Nobody ever really satisfactorily answered that. The one residual concern I have is that we had him psychologically analyzed, and the psychiatrist said he has a serious personality disorder. That was in his report. We then met him in conference, and he didn't mention this personality disorder. And I said, but look, doctor, you made clear here he has a serious personality disorder. We need to highlight that. And he said, well, the government psychiatrist doesn't agree. So what? And I always felt that we had let this young man down because our psychiatrist did not address that issue.
He pulled it. Sometimes the law, as a criminal defense advocate, can be quite disappointing.
It can be. I mean, hopefully, I think probably you and I are very fortunate. We don't have many of those cases, which are really disappointing.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's because of that that we feel them so strongly.
Well, we're right to feel them strongly.
I think we are.
Yeah. So that was London.
Yeah.
And now let's come to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
You've come with this accolade from John Matthew. And have you got any particular case in Hong Kong that stands out? If you were looking back now, as you are, we're inviting you to, is there a case that stands out, or has it just been all good, hard work but fun?
Hong Kong has been very kind to me, given me a lot of opportunities. I came here, apart from that introduction to you, I knew nobody. I came out completely cold. And then I had actually turned down an offer of being a sort of deputy attorney general. John Griffiths came to England and he recruited somebody. He wanted to revamp the then attorney general's chambers. So he wanted someone to head crime, someone to head civil, and someone to head a new department of commercial fraud. So Neil Kaplan headed civil. And I was chosen to do the commercial fraud, and I turned it down. So when I came out, they called me in and said, will you do some work for us? And I said, yes, of course I will. So I did some prosecution work when I first came. In fact, I actually did the Warwick Reid case.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I'd forgotten.
But that's another story.
Yes.
Now, I think there are two cases, and I think this shows the strength of Hong Kong. I did a lot of murder trials when I came here. This one, like so many of them, was a sad case. It took 8 years to get the manslaughter verdict that was correct. Two trials and two appeals over a period of 8 years. But we got there. And it just showed that Hong Kong had a viable legal system.
There was a road to the end which was just, or as close to justice as you can expect. I seem to remember there was a case, it's rather back in the midst of time, but it was something to do with a Gurkha and a border.
It was a Gurkha lance corporal who was charged with murdering a Gurkha officer.
Mm.
And that was a court-martial held here in Tamar. So I was instructed to defend him, which was very fortunate because it involved something which somebody from the outside would not have been fully aware of. Within Nepal, different ethnic groups. There is actually quite severe hostility between those three ethnic groups. And the lance corporal and the captain, the Gurkha captain, were from different ethnic groups. And this captain actually exploited this corporal who was very bright. And we ran provocation. And it was essential that the court-martial understand this animosity between the ethnic groups. There was always an interesting moment because of the five officers on the panel. One was, I think he was a Gurkha signals lieutenant colonel. And he stopped me in the middle of something and he said, but the king has said that all Nepalese are to be treated the same. And I said, yes, what the king says and what people feel are two very different things. But I wasn't happy about his interference. And I grabbed hold of the prosecutor. I said, we're going to see the judge advocate general now. We went to see him. And I said, if there's one more interruption like that, I'm going to move for a mistrial. He said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. But it was an intrinsic part of the trial. And it's what led us, I think, to the manslaughter verdict that we got.
So Nepal's still running through your veins, even when you're in Hong Kong.
It will to the day I die.
You're optimistic about the future here?
I think people of Hong Kong have an incredible resilience. And if you just look around you now and compare it with the immediate aftermath of COVID, see how quickly things have begun to move back. They're nowhere near where we need them to be, but people are really working. And that's one of the hallmarks of Hong Kong.
Yes.
People work. I think it's what I really noticed when I first came to Hong Kong. If you have the capacity and the willingness to work, then your chances of succeeding are very high. Much higher than anywhere else, certainly much higher than in England.
Yes.
Hong Kong was a can-do place.
Is it still that?
I think the jury's out on that.
Yes, I think I'd agree with you. Just harping back on Nepal, because it is so important to you, you have, of course, a number of fiction books.
Yes.
Novels. The Max Devlin... Now, three or four?
Three.
Three.
Yes.
It's a trilogy. Are they inspired largely by your experience in Nepal?
I'd certainly drawn hugely on my own experience.
Yeah.
Yes. I think if you're going to write, somebody once said, you shouldn't start writing, certainly novels, until you've lived a bit so that you've got some experience to draw on. I happily have lived more than a bit, and so I had a lot to draw on.
And if you were looking back on your life now, I invite you to look back on it. And we started by telling our listeners your diversity. The acting, we didn't mention actually, I think I've got a note here that you were in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, I think we did Midsummer Night's Dream. We did The Importance of Being Earnest. We did Oh, What a Lovely War.
The Importance of Being Earnest, yes, I saw that.
Did you see Oh, What a Lovely War, which is a superb production?
What, the film?
No, the theatrical production
I
here.
Didn't. I saw the film, which was very odd.
No, the theatrical production was brilliant.
Okay.
I've seen grown men who are in tears because of the sheer drama. But of all the plays I've done, the first one I did here was The Dresser, which I loved, but took a lot. And the last one I did was the most entertaining of all, I Hate Hamlet, which was a wonderful play to be in, with a marvellous cast. They were all professionals. I was just the amateur.
I'm sure you were a wonderful amateur. So we've got you as an actor, as a musician, as an author, as an army officer, and as a lawyer. A lawyer always lasts somehow. I'm sorry about that, Neville. If you were living life again, would you go for the mixed bag, or is there one of those that you think you'd have actually put to the front?
Probably looking at myself, I would have been trying to do all those, maybe even more, in the hope that one day I'll get one of them right.
Neville, you've got many of them right, I promise you. I'm so glad we managed to lasso you in eventually. Thank you for coming along. And there's so many more questions we could ask. We'll invite you back again.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure.